You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Joe Neil Conley, and we talk about bullying. That's fun. So, Joe Neil calls herself a bullyologist. Pretty sure she invented that word. It's a good one. I like it. I'm going to guess, I would probably even bet, that most people who are listening and watching have at least some experience in their life with bullying. Maybe it's in a school setting, a classroom, maybe it's a social club, an organization, a family group, extended family dynamics. Jo Neil's story is about workplace bullying. And to give you the end of the story at the beginning so that you know what to listen for, she is able to turn the tables on the person who was her bully. So that's a neat story. She shares what happened. She shares what she did. She shares how she learned to do with things with bullies, how to handle them, and some tips for what we can do in our own lives as well. I think you're really going to enjoy this story, and I'm ready to share. So let's get started. Jo Neil Conley, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I'm so ready. And so thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm happy to do it. So I start all my interviews asking my guests what part of the world they call home. Where are you?
Well, for those of us who live in Michigan, we can use our hand.
The mitten.
The mitten. I live smack dab in the middle of the mitten, which is a small town called Alma, Michigan. It's about 30-40 miles north of our state capital of Lansing. Now, if you want to put the Upper Peninsula, you have to do this. There's the lower and the upper. So, yes, that's where I call home.
I was in the UP last summer. I have a student. One of my kids is studying in Michigan, and the whole construct of the UP and who decided that it was Michigan and not Wisconsin or Canada. It's a very interesting geography. I think Michigan's a very, very cool state. I say this all the time when people ask me about it, but like I have had to consult a map many times.
Well, you know, we gave up Toledo to get the Upper Peninsula. That's how that
I
all
did
happened.
Not know that.
See, you got to go to Michigan history in the fourth grade. There was a big battle over the lower strip of the state, which included Toledo. So Toledo went to Ohio and we got the Upper Peninsula. Now, for years up until the late 1950s, you couldn't get to the UP except by a ferry until they built the Mackinac Bridge.
Right. So. That I have driven across that because that's what we did. We went to Mackinac Island.
Oh, yes. What city is your child
She's
in
Ann Arbor.
Oh, well. That's down here.
Yes. Yeah. But the first time I flew into Detroit with her, I was waiting for my watch to update for the time zones. And I was like, how am I still in the Eastern time zone? Mm-hmm. The person next to the stranger sitting next to me was like, you're still on the East Coast. I was like, how is that possible? Yeah. Fast forward to me driving through Detroit, trying not to end up in Canada, which is like, and then I was like, wait, how is this? Like, well, how am I so close to Canada? There's like a lot of state above me. Like, like many times I like pull up the Google Maps and I'm like, I don't understand how this works. Yeah. But anyway, we're already off topic. Okay. In a second, we're going to start the official interview, which amazingly is not the geography of Michigan and how it confuses me. But I have another warm-up question, which is that we say the laughter is the best medicine. What is something that you can count on to bring a smile and laughter to your life?
My dear, sweet 4-year-old grandbaby who happens to be napping upstairs. She is just precious and makes me smile, makes my cheeks hurt so much I smile around her.
Oh, that is wonderful. I love that answer. Okay, so the topic of the day is that you call yourself a bullyologist.
I do.
And we're going to hear about what you did how that became your calling, how it all came to be. Let's start way back in time way before you were a bullyologist. When you were a youngster, like 12 to 14 years old, what things did you enjoy as a kid? And did you have any idea what you wanted to do as a grown-up?
Well, I actually became a nurse. Okay. So I was, and it's interesting because my cousins, we all grew up together on our summers. And it was funny because we seem to have fallen into what we did during those summer vacations. I was always the one taking care of everybody and bandaging and that sort of stuff. And then I had a cousin who married everybody. He became a judge. So I kind of, you know, it was very, and I never really had a career path other than that. And I have enjoyed every portion of it. And I think nurses, mwah, you have my love.
Very good. That is the reason I asked to see, you know, what it was that you were doing and did it align and so on and so forth. So now next question about this whole process. All right. So this story relies on a workplace situation. That's part of the story. But let's talk a little bit about groups and teamwork and clubs and things like that. Do you think of yourself as a person who like is a joiner of groups and clubs, somebody who likes to be a part of a team? Did your teachers write on your report card that you were a good team player?
Well, when I wasn't in timeout for speaking all the time.
Fair enough.
And I did enjoy people, and I was in a group for girls my whole youth growing up. Of course, I became the state leader, the international leader, all those. Sort of led me to that place.
All right. So that was my next question about that, because some people don't join clubs. Some people are very aloof within a group and they're sort of immune to like sort of things like that. Some people join and they just like are members. They like to be a part of the group. And then there's the other person who signs up to take on responsibility and follow the leadership path and, you know, so on and so forth. Are you one of the people who signs up to participate and join and lead?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And even if I don't want to, next thing you know, and I've actually said, don't volunteer, don't volunteer, don't volunteer as I've gotten older. But I enjoy it. I enjoy helping people grow and challenging and seeing things come to fruition and all of those parts of it. So
you enjoy groups, enjoy being a part of a team, and you actually will step in and enjoy being part of the leadership in a group. So those are three of the components. I actually went to a training and somebody used a word recently that I had never heard, and we all have volunteer, and she was like talking to people about how to say no if you're being voluntold, where somebody's signing you up for volunteering and you didn't mean it. And I was like, ooh, that's a new vocabulary word. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, all right. So one more question before we get into the nitty-gritty of the actual story. Are you somebody that people might actually describe as like an activist? That word might be too strong, but just in concept, when you're in a situation or you're surrounded by something that you perceive as it's going wrong, are you a person who's going to actually step out of your comfort zone, speak up for others, organize things to try and turn it around?
That's a learned behavior. I would say that wasn't sort of my initial, but I've come to this place where I know how to do it. It's learned. It doesn't kill me. It doesn't, you know, people are afraid to say something because, oh, people aren't going to like. That doesn't matter. I've gotten to this place in my life where right's right, wrong's wrong, and say what you got to say.
All right. Very good. So it feels like I asked a lot of background questions. I hope it didn't seem too weird. But what I was trying to do was I was looking at the story that you pitched, and I wanted to lay the foundation because I wanted to get a sense for who you are, who you were when you were younger, because you've been through this. You're telling the story from the other side of this, which is the way I like to tell stories, I will admit. But I have a feeling that there were a lot of decisions that lined up almost like dominoes as this shook through, because there's always sometimes there's a choice to do something. There's also a matching choice, which is to not do something or even to opt out. And so that's why I wanted to sort of get the background of who you were and what you were like and, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the things.
All the things. Exactly.
And when I use my hand, I want to tell everybody, me and a cucumber slicer had a little tete-a-tete and three stitches and a tetanus shot later, but I'm fine. But I used my hand, so I had to tell people what was going on.
So yeah, and people who are not watching the video, she's got a bandage on her hand and she looks adorable, but she lost the battle of slicing vegetables. And who hasn't? Who hasn't?
Yes,
I didn't even, exactly. You have an actual cucumber cutter or this is not a knife?
A mandolin? It's a thing. Yeah. Okay. I think people call it a mandolin something.
Mandolin.
Or other.
They're not allowed in my kitchen. Those things are dangerous.
Well, I like it for like chopping onions, but the
Okay.
slicer part of it, I rarely use.
Yeah.
And now I don't think I'm going to use it again.
Yes, no, it's good that you still have a thumb. Moving on from that discussion. So you went into nursing.
I did.
What were you doing? Tell us a little bit about the job you had when you were in the position that put you into contact with this person who was the bully.
Yeah, I had, well, one of the things I found out in nursing school is that I'm not good with sick people.
That's so funny. Tell me more.
Well, because if you stub your toe, I'm going to cry. So
Okay.
I found out that I was not good on the floor kind of area. So I went right into the emergency room for graduation. And as an adrenaline junkie, it was fast paced. I didn't see the same people day after day. You know, they went to the floor, they went home, they went to the morgue. That was it. And I was good with that. Now, the ERs have a tendency to burn you out. And so the night that I told the guy to get his effing butt on the effing stretcher, I went, I probably should change areas. And so I went to the operating room. And I was not a brand new nurse when I went to the operating room. I'd been in the ER for 5 years, which, you know, when you first get out of college, you're still, you know, even unsure of applying all the stuff that you learned. And in the ER, we're good at making decisions. We have to be bold, all those kind of things. And then we went to the operating room, which is a whole nother world, which was a situation that actually led me to this path of work.
Okay, and so you were an operating nurse or nurse in an operating room team. How long had you been working as a nurse when this started?
Well, I had been a nurse in the ER for 5 years. Then I transferred to the operating room. And what happens in the operating room is you start low man on the totem pole. And the operating room I was in had 14 different services. So you start with general, and then you go to ENT, and then you kind of work your way up by complexity. So you start with
Okay.
more simple, and then you transfer your knowledge. And eventually, the last two services you get to are vascular and cardiovascular, because those are more intense, life-threatening. Not to say there isn't danger in all the other things, but the vascular and the cardiovascular. So I had made it all the way through that orientation to to the vascular service.
So you were in a hot, you were acclimated and used
Oh.
to working as a part of a team in a very high stress situation. And you'd been doing this. Was this all in the same sort of general, I don't know, I would say company, but I don't know if that's the right word
Hospital,
for
same hospital,
same
sure.
hospital.
Yep,
Okay.
yep, yep.
So, and you'd been there for years and years. Okay, so you end up in a situation where we're going to talk about bullying. Share with us a little bit about the, I'm going to call it the hierarchy or the like difference in power scale between you and
Yes.
the person who was the
Correct.
bully.
Correct. Yeah. She was my preceptor for this, you know, last section. And she was
I don't know
also
what that means.
the preceptor is like your teacher, like you're the apprentice, they're
Okay.
the wizard kind of a thing.
Okay.
It's the person who knows the service, spends the most time, is responsible for all the equipment decisions, works with the physicians. So she was my preceptor, but she was also the team leader of the vascular service. So she knew all the ins and outs of the vascular service. And I had been with her to a point where in an operating room, there's somebody who scrubbed passing the instruments, and then there's the circulating nurse, the person who takes care of the environment and gets all the equipment and that sort of stuff. And so my preceptor was scrubbed, and I was circulating when this incident occurred.
Okay, and a singular incident happened that set this off.
It did. It did.
Okay.
And like as I said, I had been through all my precept to all next to the end of it. And this her name's Vicky. She was scrubbed, and I was circulating. Now we were doing what was called the aortic aneurysm. And this is like you are cut from here to here. It's wide open kind of a thing. And it's dangerous because when you're playing with somebody's aorta, there's bleeding, there's all sorts of stuff. The other piece of this story that I think is really critical is that the timeliness of the procedure. You don't keep people on the operating room table any longer than they need to, and you certainly don't leave them open to the environment any longer. Well, we came to a part of the procedure. Again, Vicky scrubbed with the chief of vascular surgery. So again, you got to think of the dynamics that are going on. And here I am, the new kid on the block. I'm in my 20s, and I'm happy, and I'm so excited to do all this. And she says, "I need blah 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 retractor blade." I'm like, "Okay, I'll go get it." Well, I go out of the room. Now, There's a lot of places to look. I go to all the various places it should be. I'm tearing apart carts. I'm looking for this blade. I'm looking for all this sort of stuff. I call the center processing where they process the instrumentation. Nobody can find it. I was out of the room for 14 minutes. I remember it like it was yesterday. 14 minutes of extra time that patient spent on the operating room table. So I go huffing and puffing back into the room. I stand at the foot of the table and I look up and I go, I can't find it. And she reaches over. You can't make this stuff up. She turns to the surgeon, pats him on the hand and says, it's okay. She doesn't know what she's doing.
Okay.
And I stood there at the foot of the table, knowing I'd been thrown under the bus, you know, trying to go, okay, just finish the case. Just finish the case. So she goes, here, use this retractor. So we finish the case. We get the patient to the recovery room. All is well. This is what the key to me was. The head of, not only did she say that in front of the physician, the head of the processing department comes up to me and she says, Vicky knew that retractor was out for repair.
Okay.
She sent it out for repair. So she sent me out to get a piece of equipment, knowing it wasn't there, to make me look bad in front of this doctor and to put this patient at risk. And that changed all the way I looked at things, led my academics and all the things. And I wish I could say that was the last time I was bullied. In nursing, and nursing is notorious. When I was in nursing school, we used to say, oh, nurses eat their young. Now, this was in the late 70s, early 80s. That's how long ago this was. And if you were to ask any nurses, write it in the comments. If you're a nurse watching this, you will say, nurses eat each other.
Very interesting. Okay, so I'm going to take a pause before we dig deeper into this and talk directly to the audience for a second. I always post a discussion question on social media. So if you're not already following the show on social media, you'll find the links in the show notes. But I invite you to come and join the conversation because we're talking about a story with nursing, but bullying is a thing that transcends really lots of things. So join us there. I'll be there. You can interact with me. Maybe Joe Neal will show up and interact with us, all the things. All right. So back to the topic. So this is an incident that's like a specific incident. You're still in your 20s. So even though you've got a lot of experience, you're pretty young. Was there a piece of you that was like, oh, you know, I don't know everything. I should just go with the flow and move through this?
Nope. I knew
not
it was
even
sabotage.
For a second.
Nope. It was absolute sabotage. I'm going to use that word. Bullying, sabotage, and an attempt for her to look better in front of this physician.
How long did it take you to figure out? Like, so did this happen when you were out for the 14 minutes? Is that where you found out that she had the piece of information that knew? Or?
No, not until we got done with the case.
Okay.
I mean, I was doing all the things and I go back into the room, you know, she says things about me to the physician and, you know, you're standing there going, don't cry, just don't cry. Just
yes.
Get done. It wasn't until I left the case and took the patient to the recovery room that another person approached me to say she knew all that. She'd sent it out for repair the day before, kind of a thing. So there was no, at that point, I was like, what the fuck is she doing before?
Right.
You know?
And then the second part of that is when the person came to you and said, hey, she knew before she sent you on this wild goose chase. Mm-hmm. What do you think her intention was? Was she there trying to make you feel better in that you didn't succeed? Or do you think she was trying to build a team so that you knew to watch out for her?
Could have been a little bit of both, but I think she had heard the panic in my voice as I was calling, looking for this. I was on the phone. I was tearing cases apart. I was looking for this. It was her department. You know, she was responsible for this gal who came to talk to me. She was in charge of keeping track of where everything was. You know, in an operating room, there's a gazillion pieces of equipment, some more important than others. But she was responsible for tracking things that went out for repair and that sort of stuff. And the individual at the table, Vicky, this was history for her. I wasn't the first person she did this to.
Right. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, I don't have a ton of corporate experience because I was always meant to march to my own drummer. But that I do, office places, businesses, hospitals, they're very complex social situations.
Yeah.
And so people, it's on some levels, like sometimes it's like Survivor where like you walk into a room and people are like, hey, watch out for this person.
Yeah.
And you build alliances where you feel secure and people will have to educate you on the weirdo politics and power dynamics in the office. I'm not saying it's fun. I'm also not saying
correct.
I was ever very good at it.
Sure.
But I do think that there's definitely common experience across all kind of things that go with it, which is why I thought, what was the goal of that person? Okay. So this starts right away when you join this vascular team in the OR. Is it something that begins to repeat?
I wouldn't I, not as often to me, because I got I'm not tooting my own horn, but I was pretty good at what I did.
Okay.
Kind of a thing. But I watched it happen to you. It was almost like the circling, the weakened animal. They would, you know what I'm saying? So I watched it. And then as I moved into leadership within the, a few years later, as I moved into leadership, I saw it from a different perspective. I saw it not necessarily, yes, it had happened to me. And, everybody goes, well, so what? You lived. Yeah, but this, but the patient. But as I begin to watch it and to coach others who had been in that situation, and why were we tolerating this behavior? Why wasn't it dealt with? And what was the power? And you mentioned that before, the power structure, knowledge is power, and all those pieces. And then I watched surgeons do the very same thing to other members of the team. And so it became endemic. And it's kind of like when you're swimming in it, you don't see it. And I was like, wait, 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 I see this. I see this. I see this. And it became sort of like, the frog in the hot water. When you're in the frogs in the hot water, it gets hot. They don't know they're boiling. And that's like when you're in one of those toxic, and I'm going to use the word toxic environments. And that's, I think everybody could relate to that. When you're in it, sometimes you get numb to it. Sometimes it's like, it's just easier to come in, do my job, go home and not fight the battle. And I wasn't willing to do that.
But you stayed for a couple of years. So there's a couple of things you touched on there, which I think are important. So there's the frog in the soup, which is the idea that when you get into a situation and it's not bad, if it changes slowly, you don't notice. And then all of a sudden you're cooked. And then there's the other piece of it, which is that, when we're surrounded by it, we're immersed in it. For most people in a job situation where you're an employee, there's an element of I kind of need the paycheck, or I really need the paycheck, and there's training, sociological training, which is that you want to do well, you want to be acknowledged, so you will stay and try and do better in the job, those kind of things, and so all of that is there and present. So you actually you do a part of that. You're good at your job. You mentioned you're good at your job, so you were able to adjust your behavior, so it wasn't directly happening to you.
Not as much.
Not as much, but
Not
you
as
were
much.
still witnessing it happening to other people. You describe what happened to you as executive bullying, intimidation, and isolation. So, without like, I mean, if you can give us, you gave us the example of being called out and shamed for something that you didn't actually do wrong in front of other deciders and people on your team. What were some examples of other things that you began to realize were bullying?
Well, I can fast forward years. I did my doctoral dissertation on bullying in the operating room, because
You did.
I did. I did. Yeah.
What was
So
the so what was the
the
what was the
findings?
no, what was the
Oh.
field of study that bullying would fall under? Like, what were you?
Organizational leadership.
Okay, all right. I was trying to figure out in the course guidebook where this is a very off-topic question, but I was like, no, where would bullying be in a career? Okay, so you go on to study
I
this.
did. So, and on a whole nother personal note, there was bullying in my personal life too, but that's a whole separate episode. But so I studied bullying. I did my doctoral dissertation of bullying in the operating based on that situation that had happened years before. I kind of knew that that's where I was going to go, but it took me a while to get there. So I actually studied bullying in the operating compared to what we call the surgical never events, meaning things that should never happen. Wrong patient, wrong site, wrong procedure, retained instrument, and death of a healthy patient. Those are the five things that should never happen in the operating room. And so it's interesting because dissertation chairmans can be really twits. And this guy said, "Oh, nobody, that's not anything you should be studying." I said, "Just let me do this." So I put up my survey, and within about 8 to 10 hours, I had 12,000 responses. That's how,
Whoa.
I put it on every every OR website, I sent it out to ARN members. I mean, it was just like this huge response. So it's like, na na da boo boo see.
That's a massive response to a survey,
yes.
Which means that you really touched a nerve.
Yes.
That people wanted to be heard.
Absolutely. And the stories, you know, you get your, you know, quantitative data, but this quality of the stories were just, you know, of inner squabbling and people who left jobs and people who became ill because of that. And so what I took was there was a researcher in Australia called Marie Hutchinson, and she had developed a bullying survey that she allowed me to use it, and it measured three things. One was the predictors of bullying in an organization, the actual bullying acts, and then the consequences of bullying. And so I correlated all of those factors to bullying and to the five surgical never events. Now, when it came out, who was the, I want to say, worst bully? It came out surgeon. Now, again, this is in the operating room, so these are the people we deal with. But when you added, I was bullied by my boss, I was bullied by a colleague, and I was bullied by a ancillary staff member, it far exceeded bullied by the surgeon. So when you put that whole group up against that, it was more. So, and it came out that bullying impacted all of those never events, including death of a healthy patient. So you know that when you're being bullied, you're not at your best.
Right.
You're not able to make good decisions. You're not able to be, you know, and I'm not saying the operating room is any different than an airplane or any kind of work, but you're not sharp when you're like trying to protect your back, when you've got to make really quick decisions. So I finished my doctoral dissertation in 2011, and I found out what I already knew. It's like, okay, I know this. I mean, I've lived this. And so I kind of sat with that information for a while. It's like, okay, now what do I do with this? You know, and so it's interesting how, you know, we sometimes get these downloads when it's like, okay, this is it. So I still remember I was in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan. It's a true story. Can't make this up. Convertible top down, sun shining, and all of a sudden it came to me. It's my tool. It's called the meanness matrix. And I'm like on the car, on a napkin, writing this out, going thing. And what came to me was that we think we can stop bullying. Now, as an individual, you can't. As a corporation, you can. So that's
like the culture of bullying.
There's factors there. Yeah. But I came up with this grid where some people, we have a tendency to call everything bullying, anything that kind of riles us. And that's not true. Some people are just rude. They're rude.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate fact of humanity. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the differentiation between a rude person and a bully is the bully is intentional. It's about you. Vicky was, that was me. She wasn't bullying anybody but me, and she was doing it to me. That, you know, so you got rude people, you got bullies, and you've got narcissists. And that, and none of this is black and white. It's kind of gray. It's a spectrum. Yeah. And then if you look at this, the other axes, there are some people that are just coming in and out of your life that I say they don't matter to me. Now I always say they matter to Jesus. They just don't matter to me. Kind of thing. They're that group of people that just are there. Then you have people that are matter a bit, you know, people that are in it, you know, have some influence on your life, your kid's teacher, your minister, your great aunt Mildred, you know, those kind, that group of people. And then you have the group of people that really matter, spouses, children, dear friends, all of that. And so I created this tool, and it's like, this is how they are. This is who they are. Here's some strategies. And so I came up with actually giving people strategy of what to do when it's happening. Yeah. You know, the biggest piece I can offer is put up your force field. You know, you're not going to change them. This isn't about you. It's about them. Now, if you're thinking about the Mel Robbins, let them theory, it's let them, but let me. You're not at their mercy. And, you know, and I always coach folks that, you know, once they get under your force field, then we got a little bit more work to do. But if you can kind of, and again, if somebody doesn't matter and they're acting like a twit, let them act like a twit.
Right. Exactly. If you had been standing in a parking lot and somebody had come up and said, you don't know what you're doing, you would have been like, I don't even know who you are. And you would have just walked on.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Now, I do say this to my husband when he starts yelling at the other drivers in the other car.
Sure.
It's like, they don't care. But I think when you get to those conversations about people that really matter, that
yes.
you don't want to have, difficulties. And again, we can a whole nother conversation is the conversations over politics at Thanksgiving dinner and all those things that are going on in our world and our country right now. And having a sense of, I do want to have a relationship with this person. I'm going to work on this. I'm going to figure this out. They're in that upper tier. They yeah. matter a lot. I do say, though, when you get over to the narcissist, and I was married my starter husband is what I call him. The starter husband really was. And so when you're in that kind of environment with the narcissist or the narcissistic personality person isn't going to change.
No, they're tricky. They're very tricky. Okay, so let's back up to this. So one of the things you said is telling the difference between somebody who's just kind of being a jerk and somebody who's a bully is the bully makes it personal. And in your case, and you were talking about people who matter, I'm going to make my own classification. You can tell me if I'm wrong. Sometimes people matter because of the control and the power they have over our situation, which if yeah. you're in a workplace environment, yes. when your boss is doing yep. something yep. or a superior, they matter not because you like them and you want to have dealings with them, but because they're controlling of your outcome.
Yes, and they have influence.
Unless they have influence. That's have a influence. Much better way of saying that. Teachers,
yes.
an administrator mm-hmm. in an office can have an yep. enormous amount of influence over, yep. Think about the power mm-hmm. of like the person in the office for whether you get the appointment. And that might mm-hmm. be a really old, out of date reference, but it used to be that you had to make friends with the secretary in the office because she kept the calendar.
I'm not saying that's not all wrong. I think there's some merit to that.
Exactly. And so
think about that secretary's source of power. Her source of power was knowledge.
Knowledge, control of the schedule. Yeah. It's 100%. So I gendered that, but I should yes. not do that. I should just the person who's got control of the
Correct.
Admin, should be there. All right. Your story is actually that you conquered Goliath in this story.
Yeah.
I think did this happen before you went to pursue your doctorate
or no, were after.
You
still, it was after.
After. So
after.
You were still in school when this happened. Okay. Wow. All right. So you gathered information, you documented behaviors, and you spoke up and used your voice. And this is going to make so many people listening envious who have dreams of tapping turning the tables of people in their life. Eventually this person was removed from their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how long was this, to put it in perspective, how long was this season of your life while you were working with this person in this, this culture where it was tolerant?
Sure.
How long was all of that?
He and I only lasted together about 2.5 years. He had been there for many years before me. And if I can set this up too, is that I had, after I got done with, while I was getting my doctoral dissertation, I was working as a healthcare consultant, going into hospitals, fixing issues. It was a great job. Worked for the advisory board. I was in 4 hospitals in 5 days. I knew what I was doing. So then I met my now husband at gate 18, Washington Reagan Airport. Story.
That got sounds remarried. Like a story.
It is a whole nother story. Got remarried and, his job was in Alma, Michigan. And so after about a year and a half of being married, I came in and I said, I need a job. And so there was a job for a manager of the operating room. I thought, I could do that in my sleep. Before I was done, they had created a director position of director of the operating room and the emergency room and all these sort of things. Now, again, I'd worked in all kinds of, I'd finished my doctoral dissertation. I'd done all this. I was doing some speaking on the bullying. And I took this job at a community hospital. Now, anybody in healthcare understands what I'm about to say. I had been there for 2 weeks and we flunked the joint commission.
I have no idea what that means, but I don't want any part of my hospital flunking any part of anything.
I'm telling you, it is, you have to get accredited in order for the insurance companies to pay you.
Yeah.
So it's like a big deal. It's a big deal. And there's appeal processes and all this sort of stuff. But the point being is that 80% of the citations were in the two areas that they'd hired me to work in, the ER and the OR.
Okay.
So here I am. I'm brand new to this organization. I've got all these citations. I have no credibility with these people. I'm the new kid off the block. I mean, she flew in from wherever and she thinks she's going to make all these changes. And I had to because 80%. So the CEO, this person we were referring to, it was within a really short period of time, I realized the toxicity of the culture that he had created. He was a bully. we would have these executive team meetings, and I'd come in, you know, you can tell now, I'm like, I'm gonna fix this. I know how to do this. And he looked at me in front of the entire executive team and said, until you've been here for 6 months, keep your mouth, and he put a word in front of mouth, shut. So I worked and I worked, and I would come home every night. Bless my husband. He said, are you documenting this? And this is full stop. If you're in a situation, document the facts, the facts, the facts, the facts. Now, I was able to document over the course of the next 9 months that this toxic culture made it impossible for me to make the changes for our organization to be successful. And it was coming right from the top. He was toxic to everybody, all throughout our small organization. And we had hired, they'd hired a consultant. We're paying this consultant 10 grand a month to do the stuff that I knew needed, but she and I had become friends. And she wrote the consultant's report in November. I had gotten there in September. So this was like 14 months later, because that's how long it took to get over this. And in her consultant's report, it was not kind about the CEO. She point blank called him out, all these sort of things. And I was in the CNO's office, and he had come in, he came busting in there, and he goes, you tell her to change that report. You call her up right now. And I'm sitting there going, what are you talking about? It's true. Everything she wrote is true. And the CNO, I'd love dearly, had no balls.
Okay.
So she had no balls. So he leaves, and I'm like, you can let him treat you that way? I had it. It was so clear that his behavior was hurting the organization and, in essence, hurting the patient care. When you get down to patient care, I'm going to fall on the sword. That's all there is to it. So that was on a Friday. Over the weekend, I really did wrestle. Like, what? You know, those dark nights of the soul. And at Saturday night, middle night, I'm reading my own dissertation thinking, you're not even doing what you told people to do. What's wrong? You know, because you get to that place. I close it up, and I want you to know by this point, I had binders full of emails that he had sent, comments that he made, told me I couldn't have coffee in the doctor's lounge. I go, yeah, but I am a doctor. I'm going in there kind of a thing. It's just like all of the other. And there was a particular executive meeting where he was awful to the vice president of medical affairs. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with you people? Kind of a thing. You know, you get to that point. So Monday morning, I had my binders. I went into my office. I cleared everything. Cleared everything out, made an appointment with the corporate vice president of HR, and he met me the next day. So like I said, I had nothing to lose. Even if I did lose, it didn't matter at that point, you know? Yeah. And this is where I think people go, oh my God, people came up to me and goes, oh, you were so courageous. I go, I was not going to take that anymore. You know, it's like in my Norma Ray moment. So I go with all my binders of facts. And here's the other piece I want to caution people. When you're documenting, document exactly what the words were, not how they made you feel. I took myself out of the equation. It wasn't what, because by that point I had gained 30 pounds and had 7 ulcers, kind of a thing. But I took myself out of the equation. It wasn't about what he had done or said to me. It was what he had done to the organization. And I was really clear about that. And I went in with my binder and I'm going through all the things. And halfway through, the vice president of HR, there's three things you need. You need objective data. You need a code of conduct. I put all the code of, and you need courage. And at this moment, the VP of HR had courage. He said to me, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. He gave me his card and he said, nobody should work under these conditions. And he goes, gave me his business card. He said, if there's any real or perceived retaliation or retribution, you call me day or night. I want you to know it. So I left out of there. That was on a Tuesday. So there was things that were happening. We were opening a new ER, all kinds of things. And unbeknownst to me, that VP of HR interviewed 40 people. He didn't just take my word. I mean, I could have been the catalyst for it. But he interviewed it. And the CEO at the organization had told him not to interview his team until the following Wednesday or Thursday. So I'll never forget, I'm sitting in my office, and I know that they're doing these interviews that day because we're now like a week past. And the CFO comes in and he shuts the door. He goes, don't let me ever get on your bad side. I said, Jeff, it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with us. So they interviewed all the people. And then Friday morning, the following day at 7:05, the corporate CEO came in and walked him out of the building.
Wow. Wow. They could make a movie about it. The you said it a couple, so you were documenting the moment and you said, it has to be just the facts. And the other word that you used is really objective, is really helpful, I think, is objective. And so when people are doing this for whatever's going on in their life, one of the best frameworks that I've been offered to help people through this that you can share if you think is valid, is that you want to get it to the point where a total stranger can read it and understand what happened without any of the drama and so on and so forth. And that's actually when it comes into play. So like you were saying, you talk to one person, but when you have something that's like that's a series of events that need to be understood, often there's a little like people come in when things go really wrong and they're like, oh my gosh, he pushed me, so on and so forth. But you need, when you're creating something, it's like you need something that tells a story of a week or a month or a year that someone who's not involved at all, that like the administrator down the street can look at and be like, oh, this doesn't look like it's been, th this looks like something strange is happening. And that's the goal. So, that's the framework that I offer to people to try and help them through it. Because when we are upset and we are experiencing it, it can take a little while to get that, but to get to that point where it's like on Tuesday, 8 o'clock, coffee was spilled, like, it's like, yeah.
And I have a tool about how to document some of
Okay,
that
there you
if
go.
you
So
want
that's
to reach
very
out.
good.
But it really focuses on what was said, just the words. Who heard it? What was the situation? Who witnessed it? What was, and all of that. And then I also, like I said, I put myself down lower. What was the impact on the organization? And in this instance, the impact on patient care. What was, some nurses come up to me and they say, so and so hit a machine or they did this. And I'd say, okay, did you miss giving medications on time? Did
Right, what
this,
happened?
did you have to work, or did it ensue overtime? What were there mistakes that were made because of this situation? What was the impact? What was there a finance? And I always try to get people to go, was there a financial impact on the organization? Did this have an impact on our patient satisfaction scores? On our, we broke a piece of equipment, or repairs, or overtime at double and a time and a half kind of thing. And then, what was the impact on me? Did I call sick? Did I have to see my doctor? Did I have to go on antidepressant? And I'm saying some severe
No,
things, but.
but that's because those are other things. Because the very first time, whenever you say there's something, there's a culture of non-functioning or a culture of non-teamwork, very frequently people try to say, it's fine, nothing actually happened, right? Nothing really went wrong. But what you may not see is that, like, behind the scenes, people are getting upset stomachs before they come into work. They're calling in sick. They're not speaking up in meetings, any of those things. And you can put that. And I'm not like a corporate person as much. You can put that in a family or a school setting. A kid is not wanting to go to class. They're not going to lunchroom. They're hiding in the bathroom. All of those things.
All the,
So all of those things. All right. So that is quite the story. That is really, really amazing. You don't still work there. Okay.
Well,
So.
here's what did happen though. After he left, the new CEO came in and she begged me to, because I was going to be done. And I said, she goes, can you just help me through this transition? Can you just stay? I said, I'll give you 6 months. And that's what I stayed because I was, she was brand new. She didn't know any of the people. And I stayed, so I stayed for a while.
So you did stay for a while. You turn this becomes, I think, a career definition, redefinition for you, even though it started while you were there. You got your doctorate while you were there, so on and so forth. Tell us what you do these days and how you want people to follow up with you after the interview.
Well, I think this is an example of what I call a hot mess. a lot of times in life, we things have life is messy. Life
Life
is messy.
is messy.
Divorces and kids and problems and thumbs and all kinds of things. And so right now I coach women on hot messes. And it's like, you're not a hot mess. You're not broken. Life's going to happen. These are things, I got divorce and cancer and parent. I got all kinds of hot messes that have happened in my life. And I had to figure out how could I get through that and be okay? And I think we sometimes think it's all me. It's, oh my God, I'm so awful. I'm so terrible. And you're not. You're not broken. You are not broken. You're going through a phase. I have a 38-year-old daughter and her daughter was in the hospital for 3.5 weeks. That was a hot mess.
That's
And
hard.
And she was having all these feelings of inadequacy and all that. Because you get put in this situation. It's like, kiddo, you are in a situation that's a hot mess. You're not a hot mess. You're doing great. You're advocating for your kid. You're doing all the right things. And so I think we need people like me that say, you're going to get to the other side of this. You're gonna get there. So again, I've offered your audience an opportunity to have a hot mess coaching session with me.
Very good. Yes. You have a special offer for the listeners. The Hot Mess Hotline, a 1 hour, one topic laser coaching session for women who are overwhelmed, stuck, or facing one of life's what now moments. Normally $97, but there's a coupon you can get it for just $77. There's a link and a coupon code for drjoneal.com, and the code is imperfect77. The best way to get the links are in the show notes wherever you're watching or listening to the show, but the easiest way to get the links and the codes to all the special offers is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email list, because then it shows up right in your email. You can click on it.
Yes.
You don't tell anybody, but you don't even have to listen to all of the shows to get the special offers if you're subscribed. So I think that's a really, really great offer. I think that the work you do, it aligns perfectly with the audience of this show, because that is part of the message of the show, that it's not that we've done something wrong. It's that this is just the way it goes. And that it's very helpful, I think, to hear from people who have been through some of this stuff and are on the other side, who can look back and say, listen, I know it feels like this is never going to end, but just take my word for it for a second. First of all, it's probably not your fault. And second of all, it is going to end. It is going to end. You are going to get through it. And the next part of that is that, like, when it ends, will be the next thing, whatever it is.
Oh,
you
absolutely.
Know, it's like constant. Like, I just, for years, I played this game with myself that there was some time out there where nothing would be going wrong. And I was like, when does this happen exactly? That I check off enough boxes that things calm down and, you know, like, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't.
And we have this sense of, you know, the sun will come out tomorrow. Well, the sun can come out today.
Yes. That's the work. Like, when you figure it out, and the faster, if I can help people, you know, I'd love to be able to help people figure this out in their 20s.
Yes.
That when you figure it out, that it's like the work is finding that happiness in the moment, no matter what else is going on.
Because I'm a firm believer that there are miracles in the messes.
Often, but I mean, to give the messes credit, doesn't stand, they don't stand up and say, here's the rainbow.
No, God, no. And I would never, when you are having a God awful life, terrible things happen. Then I'm not saying that you're going to go, oh, this is a miracle. It ain't a miracle. It sucks.
And you don't, it's not helpful to have somebody come up and be like, oh, the silver lining. It's like, get out of here with your silver lining right now. Like, I'm in the middle.
Bingo. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
It's like, back up there with your, you know, I'm sure you've seen more of that, much more than I have, because you've seen much more like actual real life crisis than I think I have. And I'm lucky for that. All right. So that is fantastic. I could talk to you all day, but we got to wrap this up. Are you ready for the final three questions, Joneal?
I am. And I don't even know what they are.
Well, nobody does. I change them every single time. All right.
Okay,
very
I'm
good.
Ready.
Today, and these are random. Okay. Today in 2025, water can be simple or it can be complicated. How do you like to drink your water? Do you take still, sparkling, with lemon or another flavor added, or are you a person who doesn't like to drink water at all?
All of the above. But I if I'm going to drink it, it's just plain old ice water.
Okay.
And that's in a tumbler with a straw, you know. And if I really get carried away, I might put a Crystal Light in it.
There you go. Love it. That's a, like, is Michigan considered Midwest?
Yes.
I think of Crystal, my Midwestern friends are Crystal Light drinkers. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
All right. What's a recent good book that you have read or listened to that you'd be willing to share with us? It doesn't have to be a serious book. It could be like, you know, whatever.
I'm listening to this series called the Beechwood Mystery Magic series. And it's about ghosts and goblins and werewolves and all. And I'm just like, and it's just fantasy. And it's like, yes, I'm cheering them all on, kind of a thing.
I love that. Beechwood. Okay, I'm going to totally check
Beechwood,
that out.
Yes. Beechwood Mystery.
Beechwood Mystery. All right. If I offered you a free, all expenses Paid vacation. This is pretend. Like, so it's just imaginary.
Anywhere.
You can go anywhere. Would you pick a trip with lots of nature, like mountains, trails, camping, cabin type thing, a beachy all-inclusive resort or a cruise, or an urban luxury hotel with lots of culture and restaurants and museums?
I would pick the Upper Peninsula of Michigan,
This is
which
the this episode is not even sponsored by the Michigan Tourism
it's
Bureau. It
not.
could be, but it's not.
And
Okay.
it's, you know, we what we've done is stayed in lighthouses and turned
Ooh.
bed and breakfast lighthouses up along the coast of Lake Superior. And that's what I would do. And they're all haunted.
That is so cool. Lighthouses turned into B&Bs.
Yep.
I do have to say, the UP of Michigan is very, very cool. I've only seen a teeny tiny piece of it. I would say, for those who are tropical in nature like me, I think best enjoyed in the temperate months. I think that it gets seriously cold up there.
It does. It does. And you know, you can go. Marquette is very metropolis. You know, Copper Harbor, not so much. You
Okay.
know, the Escanaba, you know, there's all, but the whole part in the middle, you know, elk and moose and bear and all kinds of that. And the Sioux Locks is in, I mean, there's so much history
The
there.
locks are, there's a ton of stuff up there. Like, so the locks, it just goes on and on and on. So, all right, I could talk to you about vacationing there, but I even wrote it down. I was like,
Yes, good.
Airbnb lighthouses. I love that. That's it. Jo Neil Conley, thank you so much for being a
Oh,
wonderful guest today.
thank you. Mwah.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.